Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're diving into a report from the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute entitled Grow, Move, Eat, Repeat, Transitioning Agri-Food from Sustainability Liability to Asset. Its author, William Nicol, is with us today to unpack the findings. Today's agri-food industry produces enough calories to feed the global population, but it creates in the process substantial negative externalities across climate, nature and health. Global sustainability goals imply significant changes to what food the agri-food industry grows and how. Its fragmentation and industry-specific dynamics leave it structurally unprepared to deliver them smoothly. A plausible path forward lies in deploying mature and investable solutions in the short term that offer high impact, as well as strengthening innovation. The UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute report analyses promising solutions and outlines the role of capital markets and investors in facilitating their development and deployment. It's a great pleasure to welcome William Nicol back to the programme once again to discuss this theme. William, great to have you with us. Give us the headlines here. What was the agenda for you and your colleagues? Let's go back to the start of the process of putting this report together.
So we wanted to look at the direction of the agri-food industry, which for the layman is agriculture and food industry, and often you can lump them together, and look at sort of where it's coming from a sustainability perspective, and where it's going in the future. And the broad headlines are that in the past, we went through this period called the Green Revolution, which was sort of mid-20th century, where you saw a massive increase in the productivity of agricultural yields. And this really broke a long-standing correlation between population growth and the expansion of land. So the more population we had, the more land we had to cultivate to feed that population. But as soon as you manage to increase productivity, you can get more food output per hectare, or whatever other area of land you're speaking about. And you can feed the growing population without expanding land anymore. And that was a really significant period in the global agri-food history. But when you break that link, you also create a bunch of problems. And you can see this through the agri-food industry's kind of impacts on the world. And it's had a range of negative impacts. And the first is on health, where obesity and heart disease, for example, since 1990 has doubled. The agri-food industry is also responsible for a large amount of the sort of climate and environmental impacts today. So it's responsible for around a third of emissions. It's second only to fossil fuels as an emitting sector. And when you look at the environment in particular, agriculture is probably the most destructive industry. It's responsible for around 90% of deforestation and a wide range of environmental pressures, such as soil degradation. It's also surprisingly responsible for about 70% of global freshwater use. So it's a really significant impact on the environment, partly as a consequence of the significant rise in productivity that you saw coming out of the Green Revolution, but also just the way we farm today. And some recent work from a group called the Food System Economics Commission tried to value on money terms the total impact of the agri-food sector. And they concluded that the sector today generates about $15 trillion in negative externalities, which is far more than the industry itself creates in output every year. But you know, it's not all bad, because they also looked at what investment would be needed to kind of reverse that trend. And they concluded that between about 200 to 500 billion a year is needed to turn that 15 trillion negative cost into a $5 trillion positive cost. So it's a bit of a windfall, and really the investment required is not much compared to the cost that the agri-food sector today imposes on the world.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. And as with so many great contemporary challenges, there's a huge opportunity implicit, which is really interesting. One of the challenges, I guess, though, in meeting those objectives, William, is the fact that there are big structural problems, particularly given how fragmentary this whole sector is in delivering those kinds of goals and ambitions smoothly. And I know in the report you get stuck into this. Obviously, it's a very fragmented playing field. So what are some of the things we need to think about in terms of trying to move that needle in a positive direction?
Sure. So I guess the starting point to answer that is just what are the goals themselves? And you know, looking forward, you in the past, you had sort of the need to produce more food shaping the direction of the industry. Going forward, we think that sustainability goals are really going to be the guiding force to shape the direction of the agri-food sector. And those sustainability goals can be summed up in two, really. The first is climate, which is the Paris Agreement, reaching net zero emissions by 2050. And the second is this nature positive goal, this agreement called the Global Biodiversity Framework, to sort of restore more nature than we have destroyed in the past by 2050. And because the agriculture sector is both a large emitter and a large destroyer of nature, for example, from those deforestation statistics, we can expect that if we're to hit those goals, the agri-food sector will change a lot going forward.
Yeah, that's interesting, William. Talk to me a bit next about the theme of food security in this context.
Being able to produce enough food reliably that's high quality has always been a challenge, but it's changing going forward. And you can see this in recent years with how globalized the food trade network is. And coming out of COVID, you could really see these examples in some countries, like Egypt, for example, had some trouble importing wheat just after the Ukraine war because it imports 80% of its wheat from Russia and Ukraine. So you can see the sort of new ways that food security introduces vulnerability, but also resilience on a country level. Also concerns around sort of jobs in the sector if you've got a lot of potential change, as well as food prices. So an interesting finding from our research was that if you do hit a net zero scenario, so you look forward and you say the agri-food sector is on its path to reach net zero, you could expect food prices to be 30% above what they would have been in 2050. So you can see there's also inflationary pressures you want to manage there. And the idea about the sector being structurally unprepared for this significant amount of change comes from the fact it's generally quite risk averse, not because of sort of anyone's fault, if you like. It's just because of the economics of the agri-food sector. And one part of that is there's a lot of uncertainty introduced just being dependent on the weather, for example. So if you own a farm, you're not really sure what your revenue is going to look like next year. So can you invest in solutions to reduce emissions, for example? Another is just even if you do have fairly consistent weather, your cash flows are quite cyclical. So you can expect them to all come at one point in the year and then you don't have any revenue for a large part of the year. And that can lead to sort of pockets of innovation within the sector, but generally quite low innovation. And really to meet those sort of sustainability goals, so net zero, nature positive, you need the flip side of that, which is lots of innovation, lots of risk taking at a farm level to adopt these sort of new sustainability solutions. And we just don't really see that today.
I guess the sort of the headline, the title actually of this piece is Grow, Move, Eat, Repeat. And I just wanted you briefly to touch on that. It's a neat title, of course, but just tell us a bit. It's not just a mantra. It has some real substance behind it. Just tell us what the idea, I guess, of Grow, Move, Eat and Repeat is and how that speaks to some of the themes you've already described.
Yeah, of course, the name is always the most fun part of doing these reports. But the idea was that because you need to have this whole sector transformation to meet these sustainability goals, you're going to need to deploy solutions at each stage in the value chain. And if you start in the upstream where you grow food, there's a certain set of solutions. A lot of the sort of sustainability impacts, if you like, happen at that stage. But then they also happen throughout the agri-food value chain. So not just when you grow food, but when you move it from farm to the store, which involves kind of putting it on trucks, for example, driving it to storage centers sometimes, which need to be chilled if it's fresh produce, and then eventually moving it to the retail, so supermarkets or just regular markets. And then from there, you have the final stage, so where it reaches consumers in the eat stage. And that itself has its own kind of sustainability challenges, food waste, for example, being a big one. So the idea was that we would frame where you deploy the solutions based on those three buckets in the value chain. So grow, move, eat, and repeat is a sort of just play on words from the food waste angle, and that we sort of want to increase efficiency.
Yeah, and indeed to convey that this is, you know, it's a huge challenge, but the solutions need to be sufficiently long-term to move the needle. And to that point, let's talk about that three-pronged approach then in terms of how investment capital can better be leveraged. Again, there's a nice turn of phrase. This three-pronged approach speaks to finance, convening and engagement. Just talk us through this one, William.
Yeah, of course. So when we are looking at the role of capital markets in helping facilitate this transition, really we saw the actions kind of falling into those three buckets. So finance, convene and engage. And the first bit is about financial markets providing a wide sort of menu of options, if you like, for the different financing needs. Because if you're a farmer or you're a food company and you want to reduce your sustainability impacts, then you have a wide range of ways that you can finance those things. But not only is there a wide range of tools out there, but farms themselves have a wide range of ability in what financing they can take on. So, for example, if you look at a large EU farm with potentially a healthy balance sheet, if you like, they might be able to sort of take on debt themselves or use some public subsidies if they're in the EU, which tends to have a lot of subsidies versus other countries. But the financing options to, say, a smallholder in a lower income country look very different, and they might be dependent more on philanthropic capital, for example, particularly if they don't have much cash flow themselves or there's not much public subsidies available. So really the sort of enabling role of the finance sector there is to provide as wide range of financing tools as possible, be that sort of more traditional loans or sort of more emerging instruments like parametric livestock insurance, just so that the wide range of financing needs in the sector can be met if a farmer or a company want to improve the sustainability profile of their business. And then the convene aspect is about the fact that financial markets connect in every point in the agri-food value chain, and they can therefore connect all those diverse financing requirements with different providers of capital. Because as I said, there's sort of a wide range of financing needs today. And an interesting stat that we have in the report is that the average holding period for venture capital investments in the EU is about 6 years, but it's a bit longer in the agri-food sector. It's 9 years. Because generally, innovation's a bit slower, they take a bit longer to scale and reduce costs, which highlights the fact that they have slightly different capital needs to other industries. And finance can sort of, A, help just connect farmers on a farm level with those different providers of capital to ensure that the sort of financing needs are met, but they can also help share best practice through this sort of convening function. And a good example of that is this group called the Fair Animal Investment Risk and Return Initiative, which UBS is a part of, which helps to share sort of best practices amongst investors, for example. And then finally, this engage piece is more about the financial industry engaging with the investees, the people that they sort of lend money to or invest money with. And, you know, an investor can't engage every single farmer on the planet. That would be physically impossible. What they can do, though, if they want to have or to want to maximize their impact, is to strategically target their engagements at stakeholders in the value chain who sort of have an outsized influence on its dynamics. And our conversations highlighted that there are two stakeholders that have these sort of outsized influence. And the first is food companies, who generally sort of can control a lot of the market, if you like, and the dynamics within it because of that, such as pricing dynamics, particularly because they sort of procure food from farms and can therefore exert their sort of influence through things like procurement policies and sustainability standards sort of upstream in the value chain. And then the other group is commodity traders as well. So if investors engage these groups and sort of align their asks on things like ambitious sustainability standards, they can then have this kind of more snowball effect throughout the whole value chain. And so, yeah, we sort of structured the recommendations around those three buckets: finance, convene, and engage.
Yeah, and perhaps the final thing that I wanted to ask you about, William, here is, and I guess it comes back to where we started, you know, the scale of the problem and the challenge, and it requires buy-in, not just in the ways you've already described, but I guess from a wider suite of stakeholders, including, you know, public authorities. At this stage, you know, the challenge is such that we need, you know, nation states and on a supranational level for this to be addressed. I guess it's important, isn't it, to underscore that the requirement for decisive action extends, well, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, finance can be a sort of enabler in this long transition from where we are today to the sort of public goals for net zero and nature positive. But as you mentioned, you need sort of complementary action across the space from public and private stakeholders of all shapes and sizes. And we highlight in a report just a few areas where finance maybe plays less of an enabling role, just to make that point that action from a lot of different stakeholders required. And this is in areas such as where the sort of public subsidy misallocation, if you like. So where public subsidies don't incentivize actions that support those sustainability goals. And there's some interesting work by the World Bank that looks at the amount of agricultural subsidies linked to, for example, like the over-application of fertilizer. So where you sort of reduce the price of fertilizer and don't encourage the efficient use of it, which then means you tend to use more of it as a farmer and it leads to more environmental pollution over time. when you have those sort of public subsidies working against the public sustainability goals, it can make it harder for the whole space to transition. So aligning public subsidies with the goals is one important area where, for example, we think governments could play an important role. And then there's other aspects around how agri food is can be quite a political and a social sector. And those are sort of broader questions that finance just by itself cannot tackle.
Well, William, just briefly then, and maybe as a final thought, what are the actual fixes then? What can some of them look like? Let's talk about the role of technology in facilitating the kind of change that you've been talking about. What are some of the actual technical fixes? What do they look like?
Yeah, well, agriculture is quite interesting because some sectors, it's if you look at emissions, for example, you need a few solutions that solve most of the problem, like in power. You want to have your renewables, for example, and that replaces like big sources of emissions, like a gas power plant. But in agriculture, the sources of emissions are very distributed and they look quite different on a farm level. So rather than the story being a few sort of big technological interventions, you need lots of little interventions that look very different on a farm level. So it's a little bit more complicated when you look at the solutions. And so we looked across the landscape and surprisingly, there was lots of solutions, but no silver bullets, really. And what was interesting was that actually some solutions today made economic sense for farmers because they reduced input costs. So they reduced, for example, the amount of fertilizer they had to use or the amount of fresh water they used in growing crops, which helped their sustainability profile as well as their bottom line. And we called these the market-ready technologies. So one interesting example was precision agriculture innovations, which is a broad church, but generally, as I just mentioned, they sort of reduce the inputs farmers use and therefore save the bottom line. And another example there is storage infrastructure. So for example, when you're moving food through the middle of the value chain, you can create a lot of food waste if food goes off before you get it to the shop. So if you have, for example, more cold storage, which increases the length of time you can have food stored before it gets to the shop, you reduce food waste and that helps increase bottom line and also reduce the amount of food waste and therefore the sustainability impact. But other solutions were maybe less mature and we expect more innovation going forward. And the sort of middle bucket here was sort of near market technologies, which could have a sizable impact on the sustainability profile of the sector, but they have some fundamental barriers to scaling today. So one example here is vertical farming, where you can see some products in the market today, but they tend to be more expensive and there's questions around scale. And then finally, this final bucket of technologies is what we termed the early stage technologies. So these are really nascent and they could have a sustainability impact going forward, but we don't expect them to sort of appear on farms in the near term. So one example here is robotics, which could add to the productivity of farming. However, there's challenges with sort of deploying these autonomous robots in the real world, and we don't expect them to appear on farms anytime soon.
William Nicol bringing us to the end of this edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week right here on Monocle Radio. You can listen again and explore more at monocle.com or follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as ever, you can discover more and find out how UBS can help you by heading to ubs.com. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.